This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. I don't know about you, but since the rise of online banking and the ability to block most junk mailings, I just really don't get much mail anymore. It's kind of sad. But here's something I can count on. I'm sure you can too. Very sharp, multicolored, folded mailers from my state or federal lawmakers. Usually they're called something like a legislative wrap-up or a legislative report or a legislative review. Inside are photos of that lawmaker giving speeches, sitting on legislative committees, and of course meeting with their constituents. Usually they're meant to highlight the good works a lawmaker does on the job, things like, quote, fighting for a healthy economy, end quote. But sometimes it includes language meant to damage a political opponent or their party, pointing out their budget gimmicks or their risky plans. With elections only a few months away, you might rightly think that this is all paid for by campaign dollars, but in actuality, you're paying for it with your tax money. At the federal level, this mail privilege is known as the Frank. It's a practice that dates back to 1775, before the Declaration. Its use has been criticized many times since then. Just recently, Republican congressional candidate Mark Greenberg slammed incumbent Democrat Elizabeth Esty for her use of the franking privilege in Connecticut's 5th congressional district. In a statement, here's what Greenberg said. Elizabeth Esty is once again showing her disdain for the taxpayers in the 5th district. Even though she served less than 2 years in office, Esty has quickly mastered the art of exploiting taxpayers for political purposes, in this case by spending the outrageous sum of more than $200,000 on mailers touting her so-called accomplishments. On our show last month, Elizabeth Esty responded to his criticism.
I found, particularly since I'm a new member, that so people know that I'm there and what kinds of services that can be provided, I get people every week who say, I learned about this because, you know, I got something in the mail, and that's how I know that you can do this.
Now, state lawmakers have the same kinds of mailing privileges, which makes us wonder a few things. With all the billions of dollars spent on actual political campaigning these days, do we really need these taxpayer-funded mailers from incumbents, too? And unlike the horse-drawn days of the Continental Congress, isn't outreach as easy as a tweet, an email, a free Facebook message? Today, Where We Live, we're taking a look at political mail, and we want you to join the conversation. Do you appreciate these print updates from your elected representatives, or do they immediately go right in the trash? 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. We'd love to hear from you about whether or not you like this constituent outreach, as it's called. You can also comment on our Facebook and Twitter pages, at Where We Live, also on WNPR.org. Joining us by phone today is Paul Hernson. He's Executive Director of the Roper Center for Public Opinion Research and professor of political science at the University of Connecticut. Paul, welcome to Where We Live.
Thanks, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, maybe you can explain this for us. We're going to get into some of the details of franking at the federal and state level, but what makes frankable mail different than political campaign mail, the sorts that we also get this time of year?
Well, that's a great question. Frank mail is one of the legacies we inherited from the British. It actually began in the House of Commons in 1660. What is different about franked mail than regular political or campaign mail is franked mail is paid for by the U.S. government, by taxpayers. Another major difference is it's highly regulated. Regulations of franked mail, which are oversaw by a congressional committee, are pertain to who can frank mail, what they can frank, how much they can frank, where and when they can do it. And this has changed drastically over time.
You say it's changed drastically over time. Tell us about some of the changes.
Well, probably the biggest one was that prior to 1873, not only did members of Congress enjoy the frank, they could use the frank to enable their constituents to send the mail. So they would send something out with under their name, and something could be received under their name. And that's a tremendous change. There have been other changes about when franked mail can be used. Currently, there is a blackout period of 90 days before an election.
That blackout period of 90 days before the election makes an awful lot of sense for people, so that you're not using taxpayer dollars to send out political campaign messages just before an election. But is there any regulation about what this franked mail can actually say, no matter when it comes out? I mean, can you tear apart your opponents? Does it have to say something positive about you? Does it have to be, quote-unquote, true?
Well, franked mail is, let me just clarify one thing. The franked mail that's regulated or blacked out in the 90-day period is mail that goes to more than 500 constituents. So that's important to know. What can you say in it? It cannot be overtly political. You cannot use franked mail, for example, to raise money or an attack an opponent in a campaign. For that, there's election mail. And there, it is vetted by a committee. And it is, however, as many people suspect, one of the many advantages incumbents have over challengers. However, it does play an important role in democratic communication.
We're talking with Paul Hernson. He's executive director of the Roper Center for Public Opinion Research at UConn. And you can join us at 860-275-7266. We're talking about the constituent mailers that you get, the things that aren't necessarily for campaigns, but they look an awful lot like it's campaign mail. It's actually coming from, well, from you, from the federal government, from federal taxpayers. Let's learn a little bit more about it today. You can also email your questions, wherewelive@wnpr.org. Maybe you can just suss out for us, as we're going to talk to some state lawmakers a little bit later on, though, the difference between what you might get from a state lawmaker here in Connecticut versus what you might get from your federal representative in one of the congressional districts.
Well, I have to be frank with you. Speaking of frank mail, I'm new to Connecticut. I can tell you your federal representative's mails is sometimes personalized. Sometimes it is targeted to people who care about a specific issue. And sometimes it's a general mailer announcing town hall meetings, important events in the district, prizes such as academy appointments by constituents, and the like. Some of the most effective frank mail at the federal level has a survey at the end, which is not a real public opinion survey, but kind of a census to get people to respond and say what they care about. And the purpose of that survey is to collect names of people that care about things so they can be entered into a database and periodically updated about the issues they care about and what the member of Congress and Congress more generally is doing in that issue area.
So putting on my most cynical hat possible, one might say that back in the days of the horse and buggy, when mail took an awful lot of time to get someplace, and indeed that was the only way to truly communicate with constituents, there's a lot of ways to communicate with constituents for free right now. Now, yes, not everyone has access to the Internet, but you can get to an awful lot of the people in your voting area, whether at the federal level or at the state level, by sending out a tweet, by sending out a Facebook message, by doing an email blast. If you want to do a survey, use SurveyMonkey. It's free. There's a lot of ways to do this exact same thing. So why do you think that this is still considered to be important constituent outreach?
John, that's a great point you make. There are lots of ways to communicate with constituents, and members of Congress, of course, are taking advantage of them. And as a result, the amount of frank mail and the costs associated with it is starting to decline. Why do members still use it? Well, part of the reason is because it was used before, so they believe it ought to be used now. Frank mail is important for some constituencies. Senior citizens, for example, look forward to receiving the mail. They are not often plugged into social media or know how to use the Internet. And so for them, this is an important way of learning about what their member of Congress is doing. Another aspect has to do with the role of being a member of Congress. Members of Congress are locally elected officials who make national policy. That's lawmaking. That's overseeing the executive branch. It's also finding about constituents' needs and desires and aspirations, as well as educating them about bills that are important. So when a member of Congress is in D.C., that person should know, and voting or helping to craft federal legislation, that person needs to know how their constituents feel and how the legislation would affect them. Another point relates to governance in another way. We have a separation of powers system, and under our system, the president is a unitary executive who gets lots of media coverage, lots of attention, also has vast communications resources like telephones, frank mail, etc. And with that unitary voice, they get a lot of attention. However, members of Congress are often ignored, they're not so visible, and there is no unitary message coming out of Congress. And
you can say that again.
Say something, yeah.
Yeah. Well, one thing I think a lot of people wonder is, when we talk about taxpayer dollars, how exactly is it paid for? I mean, is it coming out of a fund that we can easily track? Do you know how much each and every member of Congress is spending on frank mail?
Sure, you can find that out. You can find out how much the House spends, how much the Senate spends. There are also officers of Congress, the Clerk of the House and Secretary of Senate, you can find out how much these offices spend and each individual member spends.
But is it all tied up through congressional budgets, or does this have something to do with the post office itself, an institution which, of course, at this point is kind of quasi-public? It's undergone a lot of changes, and many people say it's in quite some jeopardy. Post offices are closing all over the place. They're trying to compete with other sources of getting mail places. Does this still get tied up in the old USPS?
Well, this does go via USPS. And the one way to think about it is a member of Congress is sort of the head of a small business. The business is government and politics, and they get funds to staff their offices, to communicate. They get the offices themselves. There's travel funds that are designed to enable them to help do their jobs. For the House, there's an overall level, and then some committee members and the Speaker get extra allowance. For the Senate, it's based largely on the size of the state's population.
Before we take our break and we bring in some state lawmakers to talk a little bit about using these franking privileges at the state level, I guess I'm wondering if you think that this is something that's going to continue into the future. We've seen that a few lawmakers at the federal level, Democrats and Republicans, have come together to put forward legislation to try to get rid of the franks, saying that this is something that just doesn't need to be part of Congress anymore. Do you think that this is something that lasts for a very long time, Paul?
I think it will last because there are always people who benefit from it, including members from districts with senior citizens, but you know, other members in general. And it's hard for the chickens well, that's not a good analogy. I want to say chicken with a politician, but it's hard for people who derive advantages from certain situations to part with those advantages, and that extends to things like campaign finance reform and the like.
I think that that's pretty fair to say that voting this out doesn't seem to be in their best interests. Well, what we're going to do is take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk to a couple of state lawmakers to talk about how they use mailing privileges, how it's different at the state level, how they're able to communicate with constituents, and how this might get confused with campaign mailings at times. If you have questions, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. We're having a frank talk about franking here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about mailing privileges, sometimes known as franking. It's something that incumbent lawmakers can do. You may get these mailings in your mailbox and not quite sure whether or not they're coming from the campaign of the person who's running for re-election or coming from their actual office. Indeed, it's something that you're paying for. People have criticized it over the years, but it's something that seems like it's here to stay, says Paul Hernson. He's executive director of the Roper Center for Public Opinion Research and a professor of political science at the University of Connecticut. He joins us by phone today. He's an expert on this stuff, so we're trying to learn a little bit more about franking. And you can join us with your questions at 860-275-7266. We'll get to those in just a moment. But I want to bring in a couple of state senators, people who can tell us a little bit about this. Clark Chapin is a Republican state senator for Connecticut's 30th district in the northwest corner of the state. As a matter of fact, it represents my hometown of Winsted. So I got one of your legislative mailers, Clark Chapin. Welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate you calling in. I'm going to also bring in a colleague of yours, Gary Holder Winfield. He's a Democratic state senator for the 10th District in New Haven. Gary, I didn't get any of your mailers, but I want to learn more about them. Thanks for coming back on with us.
Thank you.
First, Clark Chapin, maybe you can just explain a little bit about how you use the legislative wrap-up that you send out to constituents. What do you put in it?
Well, the legislative wrap-up, I generally talk about some of the highlights of the session. Obviously, bills that I supported, maybe bills I co-sponsored, and generally leave room for some discussion about the budget, depending on the year. Sometimes I do support the budget bill. The years where I don't, I usually try to point out why I thought the budget was wrong for the state of Connecticut.
In a moment, I want to ask Gary Holder Winfield about how he uses his, but I'm wondering, Senator Chapin, if you can just explain a little bit about why you think that this is an important thing for your constituents. I know we heard earlier from the professor that elderly people sometimes aren't hooked up to the internet. There's a lot of people who wait for the mail to get the information about their about what's happening in Hartford. What else can you tell us? Is that the real main reason why you use this outreach?
I think it is. You know, we have, in my opinion, fairly generous mailing privileges. Those numbers haven't really changed in the 14 years I've been in the legislature, although I have supported reducing them. I would agree that there will always be a need for the hard copy, but as we enter the age of social media and even older people like myself, you know, it's my kids' generation more than my own, I'm starting to become a little more accustomed to social media and getting messages out that way. So I think there's room to decrease the numbers. I think one of the biggest problems is if somebody could tell us exactly what the right number of mail pieces per year is, we'd still be criticized if we hit that target. There are those who, if we don't send out any mail or very little mail, say you don't stay in touch with your constituents, and then there are those who say we overdo it to the point of self-promotion.
When you say fairly generous, like how generous? Do you know how much you spend on the mailings?
I do. The district-wide goes to every voting household in the district, and that's over 36,800 households. And we also are allowed to send out 1,000 pieces a week, and then what we call a buffer piece of 12,500 pieces. I very seldom do I take advantage of the 1,000 a week. Last year, as you know, because I became your state senator, and I was new to representing 13 towns, I did send out for about 20 weeks kind of an introductory piece saying, here's who I am, I want to hear from you, and here's how to get in touch with me. But after session ended last year, I suspended that, and I haven't used the 1,000 a week allowance that I'm given over the last year.
Okay, so Gary Holder Winfield, much like Clark Chapin, you were a state representative for years, and now you're in the Senate. Maybe you can tell us how you use this privilege.
Well, I think I'm similar in some ways to what Clark says. I don't use the 1,000 per week privilege that we have. But for me, it's a little bit different because social media that many of us are getting into, when I first appeared, I was using from the beginning. So I thought of that as one of the major ways I would interact with my constituents. What I discovered was while that was valuable to some of them were wondering where the mail was. So that's actually what got me to start using the mail at all.
And you say you use it much like Senator Chapin does. I mean, you don't approach any of these limits like the 1,000-piece mail limit he was talking about before?
I don't think I come close to approaching the limit usually. Again, you know, I think a lot of what is going to be successful is actual interaction with constituents. So, for instance, I think you know, John, that I'm regularly on Facebook, Twitter, and many other social networks where people, because I'm there regularly, can actually have interactions with me. And during the session, even when we're doing bills in the House or the Senate, I will actually send out messages about what we're doing real time. So I use that as my major form of communication, but I also recognize that there are many of the constituents who don't use that. So I use the franking privilege as a backup.
Of course, Gary Holder Winfield, you have a slightly different situation geographically than Clark Chapin does. So you represent a more urban area, just more densely populated. The idea of you getting out and talking to, actually being in front of more of your constituents more often seems a little bit more realistic than if you're up in the northwest corner and you had these 13 towns to cover, right?
Sure. I think that's absolutely true.
Yeah, Clark Chapin, do you see it differently as someone who represents a wide geographic range, that maybe mail is still a way that you can communicate with people when you can't go, you know, door to door and go to all the parades in all those far-flung towns?
Well, I do the best I can getting to all 14 towns, but you are correct that certainly less dense, harder to go from town to town, and just not enough hours in the day. There are also other differences, such as regional events. One of the reasons I used the 12,500-piece buffer was for Household Hazardous Waste Day, which covers, I think, 9 towns in my district. And that, as you probably know, that's not a regularly scheduled event. It happens usually twice a year. They change locations, and if you're like most of us, you have old paint and things in your garage just waiting for that day, and we certainly think that that's a very worthy thing to advertise and let people know that it's taking place. So that's one one topic that I used the 12,500 piece buffer on, and the other was a consumer guide. This year we heard a lot from electricity customers who were unhappy about rate spikes and what could they do about it, who could they contact. I found out this year the Yellow Pages, you can opt out of receiving Yellow Pages at your door. So I did a consumer guide that addressed Yellow Pages, electricity suppliers, do not call list, that's always popular, as well as generally how you file complaints through the Department of Consumer Protection.
But this is so interesting, though, Gary Holder Winfield, this idea of opting in and opting out. I mean, people are opting out of getting the local newspaper, if there is still one, delivered to home. They're opting out of junk mail. They're opting out of phone calls coming from different companies. It seems as though now there's so much stuff that we can choose to not get. I wonder if there's a different 21st century system for getting mail to people who actually need it, but not bombarding the rest of us with pieces of mail that maybe just are going to go in the garbage.
Well, I think we do have the ability to do that. I actually, some of my constituents have told me they don't want it, and we go through and take them off the list. So we have the ability to do that. The same thing I do in email during a session weekly. I write an email about what happened the prior week, and you know, I take all of the emails of people who interact with me, and when they tell me they don't want to be on there, they come off the list. So we have the ability to do that, I think. And it's a smart way to go, so that the only people who get these mails are people who are seeking it, and we are not just using public money to promote ourselves.
If you want to join us, 860-275-7266, as we talk about franking mail, mail that comes from our lawmakers, both at the state and federal level. We have on the phone with us Clark Chapin, who is a Republican state senator for the 30th District, Gary Holder Winfield, who's a Democratic state senator for the 10th District, and we also have by phone Paul Hernson from the University of Connecticut. Okay, well, you brought it up, Gary Holder Winfield. I'll go to you first, and this is the big criticism. It comes from the left, sort of good government activists. It comes from the right, libertarians who say we're spending far too much money on government. It's that, you know, we're in an election year. Of course, we're always seemingly in an election year. And I get a piece of mail from my local state senator that says all the good things he's doing. In the back, it even says, you know, we can do better for Connecticut. Stop wasteful spending. Limit excessive borrowing. It's some of the keywords that maybe his party might use in a mailing. You'd have keywords that you use in your mailing that the Democrats would resonate with. Why shouldn't we think of this as campaign spending? Why shouldn't we think of this as just an incumbent protection act that allows you to send out extra mail that your opponent, who doesn't have this privilege, doesn't get to do? I'll let you go first, Gary.
Yeah, I think that's a difficult question to wrestle with. The way that I think about it is that, as the professor had said earlier, you know, there are various ways to communicate, but one of the most effective, if you do it well, is through getting something into the household. If you can't get your body into the household by knocking a door, I think that would be mail. And so you need to know what your elected officials are doing. If they're doing this well, I think it's something that's valuable. So, for instance, I don't, and I've had issues with this, I don't generally send out the kind of stock piece. I actually go in and rewrite much of what's in mine, so that it's what I want. And often, even at the end of year wrap-up, except for this year when I was still new, oftentimes I will actually put in things that weren't successful to get the constituency to understand things that are important. For instance, like for me, the school drug zone bill, which you wouldn't normally put into one of those, I normally put that in because we've had several years where it hasn't happened. So I think, again, you can think of this as a campaign piece, but if you're doing it in that way, you wouldn't put that in your campaign piece because it wouldn't be successful. And it's just, I think of it as a way of getting information to people. I think many of my colleagues do. So, listen, I think incumbents have protection, the fact that people have our name out in the papers, and you can go down a list of things. But the reality is it's one of the most effective ways of getting information to people who you may not see.
Clark Chapin, how about you? I mean, you've said already that maybe these privileges that you have are too generous, fairly generous, you've said. Maybe it could be cut back over time. How do you view this? Do you understand that some of your constituents might very well look at this and say, hey, this really looks like something that Clark Chapin should be paying for out of his campaign budget, not something that we should be paying for out of his office?
Sure, and the statute that allows us to send the district-wide mailer, I think it was passed in the late 80s, so it hasn't changed since it was passed, if I have the date right. But one of the things it does specify, as well as our rules for other mailings, is after July 15th in an election year, we are prohibited from sending out mail unless you send me a letter about an issue in Winsted and I reply in kind with a letter. That's allowed, but any of this bulk mailing is prohibited expressly for that reason. Now, as I said, I just sent out my legislative wrap-up piece, over 36,000 pieces, and there was a letter to the editor about it's not really clear whether it's a taxpayer-funded part of my job or a campaign piece. The fact that the person chose to write the letter to the editor rather than use one of the 8 or 9 ways of contacting me speaks volumes in my mind. He's trying to turn it into a political thing. Had he called me to this day, if he calls me today or emails me and says, listen, I think it's unethical, how do you file an ethics complaint? I'd give him the playbook as to how to do that. But I think in that particular case, one criticism out of the 36,000 that I sent out was politically motivated by evidence of it appearing as a letter to the editor.
Paul Hernson from UConn, I want to bring you back into this. You've been listening to the two state senators talk about this. I know that a lot of the information you know about is at the federal level, but I've heard this at both the federal and the state level, where lawmakers are cutting back on the amount of bulk mailing they're doing, in part because there's so much constituent service that has to be done on piece-by-piece mail, on really working with individual groups within a district, that's where a lot of the money's going. Have you been hearing some of the same things, Paul?
Well, I've been witnessing some of it, and frank mail is not always as effective as other means of communication. So email can be very useful in targeting certain people. People who tweet a legislator or some other public official leave trails and as to what they responded to. So there are other ways to target mail, which is to target communications, which are much more effective than mail. And there are ways to send out mass communications that are more effective than mail. And one of the key issues is for everyone to remember that the best communication is the most personal communication. When someone sticks out their hand and say, hello, I represent you in the Connecticut State Senate, and I'd like to hear your views, that's more effective than any other kind of mail. I think another point that came up that maybe we should discuss further has to do with the frank versus other kinds of mail. So I moved here from Maryland, and in Maryland, I don't think legislators have any franked mail. What I usually would receive was a piece of mail that was paid for out of campaign funds, and that raises the question, do you want donors, particularly interest groups, to finance mail that's meant for all constituents? That may give them more influence in the legislative process, that dependency that creates.
Absolutely, and I think a lot of people would ask the same question, but at least that's money that has to be raised by the campaigns, and since it's a campaign piece, then it falls under that category. I think that it's that lack of clarity, Paul, that a lot of people, including maybe the letter writer, the person who sent the letter to the editor in Clark Chapin's district, are concerned about, that it's really unclear whether or not the piece of mail I'm getting is something that should be a thing that's coming from a campaign or coming from an office.
Right, and that's a matter of opinion, and that's why most states and the federal government that do have franked mail don't allow mass mailings and political mail to go out during what's often referred to in a congressional office as a blackout period. It is a very, very interesting debate.
I want to go to George, who's calling from New Canaan. Hi there, George. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Yes, my name's George. I'm from New Canaan. Thank you for letting me through.
Absolutely. No problem. What's on your mind, sir?
All right. One of the comments that I have is I'm very often up at the Capitol at the end of the session working on legislation or monitoring legislation, and you will find boxes and boxes, cases and cases of legislative mail under every staircase in the Capitol. It's just packed with in every spare space.
You sure do, don't you? Yeah.
With mail waiting to go out before July 17th, or behind the deadline you mentioned. And I have discovered on most of the mails that I get at home from the legislators, it's all written by the State Central Committee of the party, of the political party. And as one of your spokesmen just finished saying, that they may change a line or two, but in essence, they're taking the entire state political party's line in their mailing.
It does seem, and George, you raise a great point that I wanted to bring up. Thank you very much. The design of these things is very important. You know, Gary Holder Winfield mentioned that he'll take his mailer and change some stuff in it. But I'm looking at yours that I got, Clark Chapin, and I'm looking at one with one of your colleagues, Tony Guglielmo, his legislative report. Basically, almost exactly, it's the same colors. It's the same look. It's some of the same headlines. It's even some of the same copy. Is that where the stuff comes from? Does it come from the State Central Committee?
No, it absolutely does not come from the State Central Committee. Each caucus has staff that offers up a template and helps us put it together. Like Gary, I try to customize mine. There are a lot of times where there may be things that I think might be disparaging to the other party, I make sure that they come out. The one I'm looking at, which is should be the same one you have, because I only have one for this year, talks about fighting aquatic invasive species, and that's something that's very important to the district in the northwest corner of the state of Connecticut, and I'm not sure most state central committee members could even identify an aquatic invasive species. So I can assure the caller that these are highly customized. While the template might be the same, start from the same template, we each try to make sure that it's appropriate for our district.
It's funny, Gary Holder Winfield, as I look at this, as Clark Chapin points out, he has a whole section here called Preserving Our Environment, things like protecting state land, increasing recycling, fighting aquatic invasive species. It almost seems, Gary Holder Winfield, like Clark might be running as a Democrat or something. I don't know. But it's interesting. When you start looking into some of these fires and you see what the individuals care about in their districts, it's amazing that despite all the rancor, Gary, we end up with a whole lot of people on both sides of the aisle who care about seemingly all the same stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think in general we often talk about the divisions between the parties, but I think we are all there trying to represent our constituencies, which don't all believe exactly the same thing. And so you'll find that there is a lot of crossover. I just want to take a quick step back.
Yeah.
I think the question about whether State Central is writing these or not, I think what happens is the caucuses put together a panoply of issues from which the state reps or state senators can choose, and that's why some of them tend to look alike. But as I said, I, except for this session, have written mine almost completely, and actually it sometimes makes it more difficult for the piece to go out. So I've actually had issues sometimes with having rewritten the whole thing and making it more difficult for it to get out, which is why I think a lot of people will tend to just pick off that menu.
A last question for you guys. Are these mailers that you send out, are these done by Connecticut companies? I mean, is there a local printer who does all these legislative mailings for the Democrats or the Republicans or the individual members?
I think that each caucus gets to choose who the vendor is, and I'm relatively confident that it is a Connecticut company, in at least my caucus's case.
Yeah, I don't know off the top of my head. I believe I was a part of a conversation once a couple of years ago where I think that's the case, but I couldn't confirm that.
Well, I really appreciate the two of you speaking with us today. Gary Holder Winfield, the Democratic State Senator for Connecticut's 10th District in New Haven. He tweets an awful lot, but he also sends out a little bit of franked mail as well. Gary, thanks so much for illuminating us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Clark Chapin. He's a Republican State Senator for Connecticut's 30th District in the northwest corner of the state. He is my state senator. Clark Chapin, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me on.
Now, when we come back, we're going to continue with Paul Hernson from the University of Connecticut. We're going to talk more about this. Some taxpayer groups sometimes have some big concerns about whether or not you should be getting these mailers. We're going to take some more of your calls and questions at 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, as the country looks back at the 40th anniversary of Watergate, the scandal, and the resignation, we will revisit a conversation with former Nixon White House counsel John Dean. He was credited with cooperating with investigators and linking President Nixon to the Watergate scandal, but he was also called by the FBI the master manipulator of the cover-up. We'll listen back to a conversation we had on stage with him and Kevin Rennie of the Hartford Courant. We'll also hear from another Nixon advisor who's been critical of Dean's role in the Watergate scandal. You can join us coming up on tomorrow's Where We Live.
I've heard time and again, particularly in the district that I represent, which has got a lot of senior citizens. They like getting mail. They like having a chance to get the kind of detailed information.
That's Elizabeth Esty speaking on Where We Live, talking about the campaign mailers that you get from lawmakers at the federal and the state level. You get an awful lot of these things. They tout the accomplishments of the lawmaker. Sometimes they take a little bit of time to bash their opponents, or at least point out some inconsistencies in their opponents' records. And this is all stuff that's paid for by you, the taxpayer. It's not paid for by campaign donations. It's called franking. And we're taking a look at the franking privileges today in the program with Paul Hernson. He looks at this closely from the University of Connecticut. He's a professor of political science. He's also executive director of the Roper Center for Public Opinion Research. I want to get to Rob from Columbia quickly. Hi there, Rob. Go ahead.
Hi. I've been listening with great interest to this conversation.
Yeah.
There were a couple of questions about whether this stuff was done locally, about whether people understand that they're getting frank mail as opposed to a political mailing. And I've actually designed quite a few of these frank mail pieces for both our, you know, our local senators and congressmen, and nationally too, and also political direct mail. And as far as frank mail goes, there are really strict regulations on what we can do to make it look like it's not the political mailing. For instance, you can't put a headshot of the candidate that's larger than a couple square inches. Any photo in there has to have a description of where it was taken. It has to be a real event. Can use stock photos. And then after the piece is created, it actually goes through a committee in Washington that has to verify that it's all legit and meets these guidelines. I mean, there's even restrictions on what size type we can use.
And that's for the federal mailers, like the one we were just hearing about from Elizabeth Esty. Do you work at the state level as well with state lawmakers and their frank mailings?
We did mostly national. I haven't done a whole lot. I don't recall whether I even did any state frank mailings. We did a lot of national ones.
So when you're talking about the strict guidelines, obviously, because there's a committee looking into this and because Washington wants to make sure that they're using the taxpayer dollars the right way, there are some restrictions. What's the difference then between that and the way you're able to put together a campaign piece? And I guess I'll ask you a little follow-up on that, Rob. Is it clear to everyone who gets the mail that, yeah, this is something that's coming as constituent outreach, and yes, this is something that's coming as a piece of campaign propaganda, if you will? I mean, in your mind, as someone who designs this stuff, should it be pretty clear?
It's clearer than a lot of us designers actually even like, because we have to put prominently right in the, you know, visible in the mailing panel. We're even given the, you know, it has to be at least 12-point type, so you can't put it in little tiny mouse type that no one can read, that you are paying for this. It says flat out that this is paid for with taxpayer money, and you're paying for it. Mm. As opposed to the direct mail stuff, where all it has to say is, you know, the name of the, you know, paid for by whatever campaign committee or whatever. So there is, I mean, it does say that you are paying for it as a taxpayer prominently on the piece.
Rob, I got one last question for you, and I really appreciate your phone call because this is fascinating to us. When you hear, whether it's the professor or the lawmakers themselves saying there really is a decline in the usage of this sort of mail, it points to a trend line. And as someone who works in this world, do you see a decline in business as more people move toward constituent outreach that happens in another fashion?
I can't speak to that directly because I had worked in this for about 5 years, have not in the last year or two. So I don't know whether I still work freelance for the company I used to work for, but I don't really know what the level of business is. It always ebbs and flows according to the campaign year. I mean, they ramp up staff and do a lot more mailings during the, obviously during leading up to November. So I really don't know this year whether things are a lot different, but I can see personally that it would be a concern. I honestly don't know whether it's, you know, what the big difference is. Yeah, I mean, I can see with all the issues with the Postal Service that there could be an issue. But I did just read an article the other day that had claimed that direct mail is still very important. Again, it remains to be seen whether or not whether that trend will continue because of what's going on with the Postal Service.
And I think one of the things, Rob, I really appreciate your phone call. I think one of the interesting things about that is because there's just so much mail, so much less mail moving into our mailboxes each and every day, the mail that we do get from a lawmaker probably has a better chance of standing out. I want to bring into the conversation Pete Sepp. He's president of the National Taxpayers Union. He was quoted in a recent piece by Peter Overby of NPR about mail franking privileges. And Pete, thanks so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
So you're from the National Taxpayers Union. Just judging by the name of your organization, you can't be all that thrilled about the fact that we're using taxpayer money to send out these constituent outreach pieces. What do you think?
Well, this has been a very controversial subject because it's not just about the money being spent from the federal budget. It's about whether that money is also having an impact in the electoral world, whether it is helping incumbents to portray themselves in a positive light, despite a lot of content restrictions on how these are done, and there are plenty of them. There's still a subtle message, and sometimes a not-so-subtle one, getting through that boosts an incumbent, and that's something that a political challenger has to pay money out of his or her own pocket to try and counter. This is why groups on both the political left and the political right have been upset about the franking privilege and have tried to reform it year after year. I mean, some of the first lawsuits against the franking privilege were launched by Common Cause back in the 1970s. They were claiming that it was an unfair electoral advantage to people who were already in office. And those complaints continue, some justified, some more like sour grapes. But clearly, we need to think about additional reforms. We've got windows, for example, 90 days prior to a primary or a general election in which mass mailings cannot be sent on the House side. But we need to go further than that, I think, and look at more restrictive dollar limits on the use of the franking privilege. We used to have that in the House of Representatives. It was stripped away in the late 1990s. The Senate still has those kinds of restrictive dollar limits and spends a lot less than the House does every year, even though the Senate represents the same number of constituents as the House.
I'm wondering how you would scale it back. I mean, what are the dollar figures that are right, or the types of restrictions that you think might make for a more equitable system that maybe doesn't provide so much advantage to these incumbents?
Well, the Senate spends roughly one quarter to one fifth as much as the House does each year. You could certainly devise a formula that would curb House spending, which currently runs somewhere between 15 and 18 million a year on average. Others have said that we need to look at additional content restrictions. Then Congressman and now Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona has proposed, for example, legislation that would say members of Congress can only send out franked mailings on their official stationery. In other words, no matter what they wanted to say, they'd have to put it on letterhead. They could not design glossy mailers portraying the lawmakers in these great lights that they're getting right now. That might be a way to help to make the content more understandable, more official, and more directly related to constituent service.
I want to just quickly turn to Paul Hernson and ask a question about the web and the way it's being used now. Obviously, a great way to reach people is through internet advertising, and there's a lot of different ways to get a constituent through different types of internet advertising. Does any of that get tied up in franked dollars, Paul? I mean, at the end of the day, could we be paying for web ads as well?
We wouldn't be paying for web ads that are political, but taxpayer money goes to a congressional office and they can use it for communications. And they may have, actually, most members of Congress will have a website. Actually, they will have more than one. They will have their professional congressional website, and then they will have a political website. And some may even have another website that has a kind of a odd name that bears the name of an opponent, where you might think you're getting to an opponent, to a member of Congress or to a candidate, and actually you're getting to the opponent, and it spews negative things. So, sure, there are websites out there that are official, that have to do with Congress, and then there are political websites, and there is a big difference between them in terms of content and everything. You know, one thing to point out is if we really care about electoral competition, and that's our focus, then I think Frank Mail is probably not the place to put all your attention. Rather, it's the incumbency advantages that go beyond Frank Mail, and those are things like incumbents have much more visibility. They're known and usually liked by their constituents. They have a great deal of knowledge about the issues, in part because they have staff educating them. They're experienced campaigners, know how to do an ad and do a debate. They're informed by a campaign team that's tried and true that they used before. And they have a tremendous advantage in fundraising, in part because they're incumbents and in part because they've got lists that have given before and they know what buttons to push to give individual people, to get individual people to give contributions.
Well, so Pete Sepp, you just heard Paul Hernson talk about that. It seems as though the incumbents have all sorts of advantages, certainly, that go far beyond Frank Mail. So should we really be focusing here? I mean, is there another way to maybe level the playing field a little bit?
Well, from the taxpayer's perspective, of course, the franking privilege is a bigger part of the equation. For those who are interested in overall election reform, sure, I can see that there are lots of other avenues to pursue. There are additional taxpayer-funded advantages, of course, to incumbency. For example, if you want to boost your image as somebody who's experienced in foreign affairs, you get on a foreign relations committee or some other kind of committee that has interests in overseas policies, and you start traveling using taxpayer dollars. That's been a major controversy, especially given the fact that the disclosure rules for congressional travel, both privately funded and taxpayer funded, remain very unresponsive and non-transparent. We need to work on those as well.
Pete Sepp, we just have a little less than a minute left. We recently had on Ralph Nader on our program talking about his new book, Unstoppable. His entire premise speaks to something you talked about, which is that this may be one of the places in which a coalition of the far left, the far right, progressives and conservatives, libertarians, all come together and maybe say, this is something we maybe need to change, something we need to stop in the way it is now. Do you agree?
Absolutely. I know Ralph pretty well, and we've been working together for years on issues like corporate welfare and congressional reform. We've got a long way to go, but we're happy to be involved in a coalition like that.
Pete Sepp is president of the National Taxpayers Union. Thank you so much for joining us, sir. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thanks also to Paul Hernson. He's executive director of the Roper Center for Public Opinion Research and a professor of political science at the University of Connecticut. Thanks for spending this hour with us talking about franking, Paul. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. It's my pleasure.
Our program is produced by Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown. Thanks to Allison Ehrenreich for her help with the phones today. The executive producer of Where We Live is Katie Talarski. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to look back at the 40th anniversary of the Watergate scandal. We will revisit our conversation with former Nixon White House counsel John Dean. Hope you can join us on tomorrow's Where We Live.